So, next chapter on here, we're going to move into instrumental conditioning, some sort of foundational stuff. I think on Tuesday, I should, unless something has changed dramatically, I should be able to get my friend who's a master dog trainer to come by and bring one of her helper dogs and talk to y'all for a while about some shaping stuff and, you know, actually taking this classroom kind of stuff and doing something with it that actually pays money. So, you know, hopefully that'll be interesting. So, you know, if I knew someone that was training, like, you know, whales, that'd be cool. You know, the first three rows would be the splash zone and flood the room. Okay. So we talk about either instrumental learning or operant learning. Now, Damian chooses to call this instrumental. Most textbooks, and honestly, most people that just work in the learning behavior field, use instrumental and operant in a fairly synonymous, interchangeable way. But I'm going to use them pretty much interchangeably here. I tend to call it operant conditioning or operant learning, but either way, where these names came from was instrumental. Your subject is going to be instrumental in producing some outcome. Operant, the subject operates on the environment to produce an outcome. In fact, really, in some ways, this operant is probably the older designator in that people start talking about operants very early on, operant responses. So, anyways, I don't care terribly much, you know, what you go with there. There are some fairly key elements in operant conditioning or operant learning paradigms. There needs to be a discriminative stimulus. May not always be incredibly obvious. I mean, just like in classical conditioning, we talked about how we could have contextual cues. You can have the same thing in operant situations. So even though, you know, you think you've set up a really obvious discriminative stimulus of a green light, you know, whatever, your subject might have picked out something else entirely. And different subjects do different things. So, for example, I remember at a, oh God, this is years ago, back in the mid-90s, being at a talk, Canadian Psych Association conference, and one of the presentations there was a team from Japan talking about, they work with pigeons, and their question basically just said, can our pigeons actually recognize the individual people in the lab? And so they took pictures of the various people in the lab, and they found out that the pigeons could identify individual humans. They said, well, how are they, you know, this is sort of a study in categorization and classification here. So, well, how do they recognize people? Like, how do they recognize things? It turns out, while all the pigeons of the group could recognize individuals in the lab, distinguish between them, they found that each of the different pigeons did it in a different way. Right? So, I mean, some pigeons would use, you know, Sandra's nose, others would use, you know, her glasses, you know. So to the different pigeons, different features of the human faces were individually salient. You know, some of them, you know, I remember one of the guys there in the picture has huge sort of Tom Selleck sort of kind of cheesy mustache, and it's like, except in this case, the pigeons really noticed this. And so it's like a massive caterpillar over your lip, and they're probably all going, oh, he's food guy. So in this sense, discriminative stimuli, we may try to set them up in the laboratories, these very distinctive, nice things, but it may be that your subjects pick something else out, especially if it's in much more of a real-world context. Okay, so that's one element. We've got a discriminative stimulus. There's going to be a response of some sort. The response may actually be even to choose not to make a response. Okay, so, but either way, there's a... this is why operant conditioning sometimes... You don't tend to see this too often in the literature anymore. But they used to sometimes talk about voluntary conditioning. So you have to voluntarily make an action. So it's pretty much dropped out. But if you're reading, ever encounter some older literature, they distinguish between, sometimes people distinguish between, say, classical conditioning and operant by saying, well, operant's voluntary, right? You choose to make that response or to withhold the response. You know, is it really a choice? Is it always cognitive? Is it voluntary? That becomes some of the questions. And, you know, in humans, it seems sometimes not. It can actually be so conditioned it becomes almost automatic in that sense. So we don't tend to see that terminology very often anymore. Literature has changed on that. But there's definitely, you got a response or not making a particular response there. And then finally, there's going to be the outcome. Now, you're going to have either appetitive or aversive outcomes. And again, you have to know something about the species you're working with. And even within the species, you need to know something about the individual. So, you know, I often say stuff like this. You know, I'll often say, oh, rats love chocolate. Well, most rats love chocolate. But rats are extremely nervous about new food. If they've never encountered it before, rats, like, you know, they can't vomit. So easy to get taste aversion. They can be poisoned really simply. And so they encounter something they never had. It's like, oh, I don't know. You know, should I eat it? It can take a bit of shaping, you know, to get them to actually consume the chocolate. And again, while most, particularly male rats, just love chocolate, there's always the odd one. There's always just the occasional sprag dolly rat I work with is like, yeah, no, can't I just have my dry kibble? It's like, dude, seriously, that's like eating a I don't know, a bran muffin, and I'm giving you like chocolate. It's like, yeah, I'd rather have the bran. You are so weird, but okay, fine. So, you know, now this is something as well. People that work in the field, they tend to get a little bit sloppy sometimes. So they'll just say, well, you know, we'll certainly encounter this in the next chapter when we're talking about different schedules. So, you know, on a fixed ratio schedule, you deliver the reinforcer. It's like, well, you deliver, you know, you make a response and you get some outcome, and then we find out if it's a reinforcer depending upon whether the behavior increases or decreases. But that takes a long time to say. So, you know, we sometimes get a bit sloppy about this. Reinforcers or punishers in that sense. So just keep some of those things in mind. But, I mean, what's going to be an individual reinforcer, an individual appetitive outcome for one member of a species may not be for another. So in terms of our outcomes and effects, we can either have positive or negatives, and reinforcers and punishers. Now, the positive negative is just, it doesn't mean something is good and something is bad. Positive, something's delivered. Negative, something's taken away. So it's much more mathematical in that sense, additive, subtractive. Reinforcer, punisher. Reinforcer causes the frequency of a behavior to increase. A punisher causes the frequency of behavior to decrease. So we need to know the effect on the behavior before we can actually label something a reinforcer or a punisher. Now again, you know, as I said, we tend to sometimes get a little bit sloppy. It's like, so we give the chocolate to the rat. It's a reinforcer. It's like, wait, you just said that not all rats like chocolate. It's like, yeah, okay. We give whatever it is to the rat that individual rat finds appetitive, and so we sometimes cut a little corner on that one. But keep in mind, you really have to know. And I guess, look, it's not necessarily that important for just trying to grasp the, you know, stuff in for exams, the stuff that you need to know about, okay, reinforcers make, you know, increases. We give reinforcers, the rat responds faster. But if you're going to take this and go on into an applied field, teaching, therapy, dog training, you know, whatever it happens to be, it is very important to remember that individuals will have potentially different preferences. Okay. Now, your textbook, so let's back up here. So we can have positive reinforcement, negative reinforcement, positive punishment, negative punishment. Okay, so positive reinforcement, something's delivered, causes behavior to increase. Negative reinforcement, something aversive is removed, causes behavior to increase. Positive punishment, something aversive is delivered, causes behavior to decrease. Negative punishment, something appetitive is removed, causes behavior to decrease. Okay, so those are our four there. Now, Damian, for whatever reason, and I think he's wrong about this, but, you know, it's his textbook, not mine. Damian just says there's punishment, what I'm calling positive punishment, and what almost everybody else calls positive punishment, and then there's omission training. And what he calls omission training, he really means negative, really negative punishment. Okay, so the text just says omission training is the withdrawing of a source of positive, you know, you withdraw sources of positive reinforcement. It's like, okay, wait a minute, but to be able to say that, we then have to know, is this really something that produces positive reinforcement or taking away? Have we already done that study to find out? Okay, so anyways, there is what's called an omission training technique. We should encounter this later when we talk about operant and classical conditioning and the effects and the role they play on each other and can they interact or not. So there's a standard technique where, which is called omission training, where if you make the operant response, an appetitive stimulus is withdrawn. So discriminative stimulus, if you respond, thank you for playing, you suck, you don't get this little appetitive thing, the piece of food, the electrical brain stimulation, the whatever it happens to be. If, in the presence of the discriminative stimulus, do not make the operant response, you do get this appetitive stimulus. Okay, so that's what's called an omission training technique. So remember I also said before, sometimes the response is not responding. Okay? And so Donovan's kind of taken this and for whatever reason he doesn't seem to like calling it negative punishment. I don't really know why he's got this sort of bugaboo about this. I know some people that work with, say, children or dogs don't like talking about using punishers, and he's certainly describing when he describes this, like, time out. That's omission training. You know, kids are you know, do something wrong, they're put in the corner, and they lose access to all the fun things they were doing before. It's like, yeah, okay, why don't you just call that negative punishment? Something appetitive is removed, access to the appetitive stuff, and the behavior goes down. So one of the things I don't like about omission training is you withdraw the source, you know, the source of positive reinforcement, but the question is, does that actually cause the behavior to go down? So consider we've got a child who, I don't know, misbehaves in, actually here's one. I generally loathe and despise Dr. Phil, one show he did, he had celebrities on, they're talking about whatever their things were, and I remember one of them going, I've tried using this this timeout thing, Dr. Phil, with my kids, so I did something wrong, sent him to his room, doesn't work, just doesn't work. Phil's going, well, what's in his room? He's like, well, it's a television, it's his computer, you know, it's all his toys, it was phone, and, Yeah, so, you know, you've taken away the access to these positive reinforcers down in the rest of the house. So omission, you've lost access to the whatever it was you were just doing. But you sent the kid to his room where, you know, he can go on and Twitter about how he's just been sent to his room and talk to all his friends about how I've just been sent to my room, how unfair that. In which case, this is not actually, you know, negative punishment in this sense at all. There's something perhaps even more reinforcing. It's like, no, I'm going to misbehave, so you do send me to. No, no, you're supposed to be down here with the family interacting. Screw the family. I'd rather be up in my room playing, you know, World of Warcraft or something. Let's see, what am I going to do? Oh, I'll punch my sister. Yeah, okay, go to your room, young man. Right? You know, but you can call it a mission training. It's like, well, here you go, a mission training. You've removed this positive family experience. They're cut out from stuff. Yeah, but we don't know whether, just by calling that, we've taken away this source of positive reinforcement. Does it actually cause the behavior to decrease or not? So, look, you know, it's sort of one of my pet peeves about this. You've kind of gathered that. But it's something to think about. It's something to think about, especially if you're going to go on in any sort of applied field, be it teaching, be it marketing, be it therapy, that sort of force you to think a little bit about how you're using these sorts of stimuli to get particular effects. So anyway, this is what I've kind of been babbling on about here for the last few minutes, my little rant. So I said, you know, Damian, for example, is very picky on his use of operants versus instrumentals. So if you look on page 151, he talks about how, blah, 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 this will be an operant, but it's not necessarily an instrumental response. It's an operation from the environment. It's not necessarily instrumental in achieving the outcome. It's like, okay, so fine. He's kind of picky on that, but I think he's very, you know, my point of view. And I'm sloppy about that, right? I'm just saying, you know, instrumental, you're instrumental in producing an outcome. Operant, you operate on the environment. So, okay, fine. I'm kind of sloppy on that one. But he's quite sloppy on his reinforcement punishment issue here. I think he's worse than this, despite the fact that he's got the book, which is, you know, used in universities all over the world and is, you know, far more important than I am. So, okay, fine, whatever. Look, just be clear about an outcome's effect in terms of whether it increases or decreases a behavior, especially if you go out and try to apply this stuff. Otherwise, you're going to be kind of surprised by things. No, I followed, you know, the teacher's manual on child misbehaving in class, sin to principal. The child got even worse. Boy, this psychology stuff, that's just crap. It doesn't work. It's like, you didn't actually have something that was a punisher. But, whatever. The kid wants attention. You gave him adult attention. Way to go. You just reinforced them. Okay? So, you know. Moving on. All right. In terms of methodologies and procedures, broadly speaking, we can tend to categorize or classify methodological styles into sort of two ways. We can talk about discrete trials, and we can talk about free operants. A discrete trial protocol is where you have to do sort of one trial at a time, then you have to reset your apparatus or recording material or whatever. So, rat runs through the maze, rat gets into the maze, rat eats the food. You got to not get the rat. You got to take him out of the end box or the goal box, move him back to the start box, rebait the goal box, you know, set your camera back up if you've been filming this, or, you know, whatever. Okay, so you've actually got to keep interacting with your subject there and trial by trial. Typically, we do things in discrete trials like measure things like latency or running speeds or reductions in errors. Or in some cases, we actually specifically use a topographical measure of what the subject's doing. We look for the particular form of their behavior. We'll get an example of that in just a little bit. And that means you have to actually watch each trial very carefully just to see how exactly did the subject press the lever to get the food? His left paw, right paw, nose, what happened there? Okay, but those would be discrete trials. You tend not to be able to get as much data in discrete trial experiments because, you know, it's slower, you got to keep resetting. You may have to be specifically observing each individual trial. It may not be automated. Contrast this with what are called free operant protocols. In this case, something like an operant chamber is an excellent example. You put your subject into your operant chamber, you know, you can press away on the lever there, whoops, get something for it, presses some more, and on it goes. And, you know, if you're using little bits of food or water as the outcomes, then great. I mean, you know, your food dispenser can hold hundreds, if not thousands, of little pieces of tiny food. So, I mean, you could probably keep your subject in the operant chamber, you know, for a week at a time, and can press whenever it wants and respond or take a nap or go poop in the corner or do whatever it wants to do. But you don't have to keep going in. It's like, oh, you press the lever, you got that outcome. Hold on, we got to reset the lever, put it back in position, go put some more food on there. Okay, you don't have to disrupt the subject there. So in this sense, it's much less disruptive. You can get a lot more data out of this. They can be highly mechanized. They don't have to be, but I mean, nowadays with computers, electronics, and whatnot. We can mechanize this spectacularly. But you tend to use a measurement of response rate. You tend not to, if you're doing this, you know, you put your rat or your pigeon in the operant chamber, you close the door, and you kind of go away for a few hours and just let the computer collect the data, right? And so you don't always watch exactly what's going on. And that sometimes is a little bit of a problem. We'll talk next class about choice studies, choice behavior. And remember one of my profs, I was a grad student talking about this, did a study with, I'd say it was a monkey, rhesus monkeys, and on choice. And so left and right lever and different, you know, reinforcers and whatnot. And, you know, they just put them in the operant chamber and off you went. They were careful. They measured. The monkey shouldn't have been able to push both levers at the same time with its paws, right? One way, I mean, you know, if you're using pigeons, this is never an issue because they got one beak. They can only peck one thing at a time. But if you got rats, two levers, if you put the levers too close together, right, they'll just go bang, 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 bang with both paws. And from the operant chamber's, you know, electronics point of view, that's fine. You know, all they're doing is, you know, measuring the number of responses on each of the individual levers. But they checked this with the monkey. The monkey couldn't actually reach both levers, so it couldn't just sit in the middle and whack away at both of them. And yet that seems to be exactly, you know, after they finally sort of stopped, looked at the data after collecting for a couple of weeks, it's like, wow, what the heck is going on? This monkey is getting every single reinforcer perfectly as soon as it's supposed to be delivered. But we measured the arm span of the monkey. You can't do that. Finally, it's like, yeah, we should actually maybe watch this and see what's going on, right? Turns out the monkey would balance on, like, you know, its one leg, back leg, tilt to the side, press one lever with its left paw, hand, and the other lever with its foot. You could reach that way, you know, add the torso length and the leg length, and they're smart monkey, okay? Dumb researchers. You know, score one for the lower primates. So much for our vaulted cognitive abilities. But in a sense, we get, as even as researchers, once you've done this, you get a little bit conditioned yourself, right? It's conditioned. You know, it's like, oh, yeah, we're doing a free operant. All we do is we just measure response rate. Animal into the operant chamber, close the door, you know, go get some coffee and catch up on your reading or data analysis, whatever. Let the machine collect the data. So discrete trials actually generally forces you to sit there and watch what's really happening. And, you know, I sometimes think we perhaps don't do enough of that anymore because sometimes you find some very unexpected things by just watching your subjects, seeing what they just do. So anyhow, where did this all sort of begin? Well, whereas Pavlov is seen as the progenitor or founder of the formalized study of classical conditioning, we got to sort of credit Edward Lee Thorndike with the beginnings of he wasn't necessarily the first person to start doing like maze studies or things like this, but he was sort of the first one to take these kinds of studies and contextualize them within a theoretical framework. So kudos to Thorndike there. And he really started doing this when he was an undergraduate student, so doing a three-year bachelor's degree in psych. He was running chickens through mazes up in his dormitory bedroom and collecting data at this point for his, you know, honors thesis. And out of this, I mean, basically starting from his undergraduate honors thesis, you know, when he's like 20, he's producing the basic groundwork for his theory of operant conditioning. And it's really where all the rest of this comes from. So no pressure, but Thorndike's making you guys probably look a bit bad at this point. So get to work. Very interested in what was called animal intelligence at the time. So he'd use things like mazes initially. He pretty much came to the conclusion that they actually weren't all that intelligent, because he was thinking of intelligence in very much a human sort of way, in that there'd be, you know, you'd suddenly get insights into how the system, you know, it says human intelligence, it's like you suddenly get an insight into how the system works, and you move beyond the conditions, the parameters of whatever you're doing, and you can make leaps of logic and produce brand new things. And, you know, in some ways, he's very much a product of his 19th century, late 19th century perspectives there in terms of what he's calling intelligence. But anyways, so he starts out working with mazes, making mazes out of standing his textbooks up on end and running chicks and young chickens through them. He goes off to for grad school to Harvard, works with William James for a little while, starts doing his puzzle box work with cats at that point. Then he gets essentially a scholarship called a fellowship to Columbia, I think it was, and so leaves Harvard and heads off to Columbia and finishes up his work there. It's got a little video of what he was doing here with the puzzle boxes with the cats. This is not a bad video, I guess. There's a few things that bother me, like when Thorndike was doing this kind of stuff, he was like 21, and the actor in this is clearly looking like he's much, much older and sort of things. And there's some other stuff anyways, but you know, for what it's worth.
But how is a new skill learned? That was a question which began to fascinate Thorndike. But how is a new...
Yeah. He also wasn't really doing this in, like, you know, a nice room like this. With William James, he was stuck in the basement, the cellar of William James's house. It's like, where am I going to do this? You know, Professor James, my advisor, it's like, I can stick you in my basement. Oh, okay. Dark, damp, you know. And then for when he went to Columbia, he was like stuck in an attic someplace, you know, small, dusty attic to over, I think, the psychology wing or something like that. So, you know, anyways, I quip about these sorts of things, you know, masters in history.
Skill learned. That was a question which began to fascinate Thorndike. To answer it, he built some ingenious puzzle boxes from which cats could only escape by operating latches.
And there you go.
The cat appears to be very clever in engineering its escape, solving the problem with a deftly placed paw and a push of its nose.
The cats also don't seem as angry about this as everything else I've read about them. Suggest they've made a very large puzzle box for this recreation. Most of the stuff he was getting from, like, Heinz ketchup crates and things, he was dumpster diving in the back alleys of restaurants. So it would have actually been a lot smaller. But
Thorndike didn't believe that an animal, even a clever cat, understands the consequences of its behavior. When he placed a cat in the puzzle box for the first time, Thorndike was unable to see any evidence of flashes of insight. The successful actions appeared first by chance. He proved that the apparent cleverness arose by trial and error, and used graphs to measure the rate of learning.
He also didn't actually label the axes on his graphs, but they've done that quite nicely here as well, so they're making him come off slightly more organized than he perhaps actually was. He knew what it meant, but...
A well-practiced cat quickly recalls the actions that help it escape to its reward of food. Brings a reward, Thorndike believed that that action becomes stamped into the mind. In his thesis, he explained further his ideas about learning, that behavior changes because of its consequences. He called this his law of effect. which explained how even wild creatures develop new habits.
Okay, so, right, trial and error learning. And as I said, I mean, he was thinking of insight as, you know, as they said there, these sort of flashes, or intelligence as these flashes of insight. He didn't really see that. So he eventually came to be very much of the opinion that there was in fact a real difference between human and non-human intelligence. He tried, for example, to get cats to do observational learning. I mean, he knew that humans do observational learning, that children obviously observe things from parents and other kids and will copy this, but he couldn't seem to get cats to do it. And so he came to, you know, coming to these conclusions. There really is something categorically different. You know, a little bit of Cartesian dualism, you know, creeping in here. As it turns out, he just had a poor methodology for cats. He let naive cats watch very experienced cats who were excellent at getting out of the puzzle box, and it's just like, you know, bip, bip, boop, bop, pshoom, gone. And the naive cats was like, what? It's like, so there was a thing, and you did a thing, and some other thing. I'm confused, right? But if you let the cats watch, a naive cat, an observer, watch another naive cat as the learner go through the whole thing. It's like, oh, yeah, don't do that. Okay, yeah, I see, yeah. So in that case, they can have observational results. Anyways, but this is where it really sort of starts. This is where we start with the formalized study here. And he was doing discrete trial, right? Discrete trial procedures there, right? He has to get the cat after it, you know, stuff it back in the box, put out some more fish or tuna or whatever he's got there on the plate, reset everything back up. So, you know, that could be disruptive. You know, it slows things down. So as I said there, he formulates this law of effect. So responses that are followed by an appetitive outcome are going to increase in frequency. Responses followed by an aversive outcome are going to decrease in frequency. He actually sometime later called this the law of positive effect, and for reinforcement, the law of negative effect for punishment, and thereby getting two laws to his name for the price of one, in essence. So, but still, you know, by about 23, he's got like a pretty important, you know, theory of learning out there. He ended up working a great deal in essentially child psychology, educational psychology, as it turns out. You know, there's probably a very interesting historical thesis to be, you know, written by somebody on why so many of the early behavioral psychologists ended up in educational psych, or applying this to educational psych, changing attitudes towards children in the late 19th and early 20th centuries there. Anyhow, Thorndike's law of effect is what we now call a stimulus-response learning theory. In some ways, it's kind of unfortunate. We keep encountering, like, SR or SS terminology, and you know, even going back to habituation with, like, you know, our habituation systems and whatnot, it's a little unfortunate that psychologists keep using the same bloody letters over and over again, because they all mean subtly different things. So, sorry about that. Not my fault. Okay? What he's saying here is that you more with experience, so make some responses, then in the presence of a particular stimulus, so cat, you know, the stimulus, what's the stimulus? The puzzle box, the particular puzzle box there. Now, in the presence of this particular puzzle box, it's come to associate this puzzle box with making a particular response. I'm in the box. I flip the latch, pull the string. That's what I do to get out. Okay, so an association between the stimulus and the response gets altered by the experience. And when the cat's initially in the puzzle box, has no idea what it's supposed to be doing. So it just tries any old random sort of thing. But after experiencing these appetitive outcomes, certain of these behaviors get, as I said, stamped in. The association gets formed in the presence of the stimulus. Make this response or responses. Now, what's interesting here is Thorndike entirely ignores the whole issue of outcome in terms of his, like, stimulus-response learning, right? Despite the fact that his law of effect is really critically dependent upon outcome. We'll come back to this later in the course, but there are limitations. By just talking about stimulus-response learning systems, or theory of learning, operant conditioning, operant learning, that's just stimulus-response-based, you say, well, wait a minute. So if we change the outcome somehow, this should have no effect, right? It's like, oh, wait, it does. So despite the fact that he works the outcome centrally into his law of effect, he just sticks within a stimulus-response learning system. Okay. Question is, what's actually happening here? Now, Thorndike's day, he had no way of filming this, you know, making a movie of what's going on. First off, he's like dead broke. Second, I mean, film cameras, you know, not really available to something. The early work in film was being done. But third, I mean, the kind of cameras that were available at the turn of the 19th to 20th century there were basic crap. So he wouldn't have even gotten very good film stock if he could. So he has to just watch this as well as he can. And he uses very simple. I mean, he's not even describing the particular behaviors here. All he's really doing is using a measure of escape latency. So that's what Thorndike records, because that's easy. So put the cat in the box, start the second hand on his watch, stop the second hand on his watch when the cat gets out. Escape latency. That's it. About 45 years down the road, we get Guthrie and Horton. Now, Guthrie and Horton do have access to, by this time, some pretty good film camera technology. So they go back and do a variant on Thorndike's puzzle box study. They use cats. They've got a box. But in this case, whereas Thorndike had like 15 different puzzle boxes where, you know, it starts with flip a latch, then it's flip a latch, pull a string to open the door, flip a latch, pull a string, press a button, flip a latch, pull a string, like step on a pedal, pull a knob. He kept making them more and more complicated for the poor cats. You know, anyways, Guthrie and Horton kept it simple. They had a pole that was sort of precariously, or sort of stood up, was able to stand up there. And if the cat knocked the pole over, this flipped a little switch that would cause the door to open so the cat could get out. Okay, so that's what they're doing. Much, much simpler in this sense. They weren't the point wasn't to try to see how many steps the cats could do here. What they, and they filmed this. So they got the camera set up, and they actually filmed this, and they slowed the film down, they watch it frame by frame, and look for specific behavior. So they're not just doing escape latency. It's like, yeah, we can do that too. But they want to know exactly what the different cats are doing when they produce a response that causes the door to open. Right? They're interested in, you know, that stamping in process, what they called the mechanical strengthening process. So what they find is that they're individual cats come to produce extremely stereotypic, individual stereotypic behaviors. One cat will knock the pole over by butting it with his head. Another one will do it by batting at it with a paw. Another one will just sort of like lean up against it and kind of just like roll on top of it. All of these various different things. So the different cats have different ways of doing this. So very consistent within an individual. And on every trial, you know, after each cat comes up with a way of getting out of the box, it tends to stick with its technique. I mean, you know, sometimes they'll approach, you know, for the cat that just sort of leans up against it and knocks the pole over by sitting on it, right? I mean, sometimes it approaches from one side of the box, sometimes the other, you know, sometimes with its right side, sometimes the left. But generally, you know, it's not changing it up every time. Hey, last time I knocked the pole over by leaning on it, this time I think I'm going to, like, chew through it. You know, once it gets something, it just kind of sticks with it. But there is variability across the individual, so different cats do it in different ways. Now, they call this the stop action. They call it stop action. They said, right, so we get cats are doing some sort of behavior, you know, whatever they're doing, trial and error. They're just doing different stuff in there. And then they do something. You know, behavior X causes the pole to tip over. Boom, there it goes, bang, door opens. out they go. So as soon as the pole tips over, that stops the actions that the cat's performing. And then the cat leaves. Okay, so they're doing whatever. They're scurrying around in the cage. They knock the pole over. Door opens. They get the appetitive outcome. Zoom, they're gone. Well, they're no longer trying. You know, they're no longer doing behaviors in the cage. So that sort of behavioral system stops there. Now, so we get the, you know, random in scare quotes here, right? Right? But the cats are doing like random, you know, quote unquote, random things inside the cage, and something accidentally, you know, not intentionally probably, they never saw a film, they never saw in their film anything of like the cat just sort of sitting there, you know, staring at the pole going, what should I do? What should I do? Let's try this. And then they go, no, that didn't work. Let me try something. No, I mean, they're just running about doing something. Flip it over. Okay. So, somebody seems random here. Now, that being said, there's good evidence that there's individual predispositions. So, you know, our hypothetical cat here that leans against the pole and knocks it over by sitting on it, you know, maybe this is a somewhat fatter cat. It's, like, tired a lot because it's carrying some extra weight, and so it just flumps down a lot. Well, if it's a cat that's just kind of going to flump itself down, sooner or later, it's just going to be pretty likely to bump into the pole and knock it over. Let's say we've got another cat that's got some real, you know, issues to work through. I mean, it's a very angry cat. Spent a bit too much time on the streets, having to fight for its food, that kind of thing. So, you know, it's trapped in the box. It's kind of frustrated. This activates its predisposition of, I'm going to fight something. And so it starts, you know, gets its claws out and starts, you know, swiping around at something. Boom. Just more likely it's going to knock the pole over by doing that. And so by looking at this, you know, or maybe another cat bites at things a lot, you know, bites the pole. If this leads to the appetitive outcome, so, you know, individual cats will do a variety of behaviors. But if they're either innate processes or past learning lead to a predisposition. So, you know, our hypothetical fat cat here has got a 60% chance of flumping down on its butt someplace, but only a 5% chance of popping its claws out and taking a swipe at something, odds are that cat's going to be more likely to hit upon a behavioral response of bringing the pole down by sitting on it. For another cat that's got, you know, a 90% chance of taking a swipe at something, right, it's just more likely that eventually that's the thing that's going to cause the pole to knock down, and that then will be the last behavior that occurs before the stop action outcome of the door opening occurs. Okay, so this is what can lead to the dominance, say Guthrie and Horton, of one response. Whatever it is that you're most predisposed to be doing here is going to be the thing that most likely gets you the appetitive outcome, the reinforcer, if you like. Now, it sounds good. It does a nice job of explaining a lot of things here. And again, you got to remember, with these sort of Thorndikean processes, the trial and error, there's no shaping going on. It's not like either Thorndike or Guthrie and Horton were trying to go, okay, we want this cat to use its tail to knock the pole down. Yeah, that'll be different. You could probably shape it to do that. It was just like, whatever. We don't care what you do. Just see if you can get out. Okay. Well, there are some difficulties with the stop action interpretation. So, Munzinger in 28 worked with guinea pigs. Incidentally, this is apparently an award-winning, I think it's called a Belgian Red guinea pig. I didn't know this, but apparently, just like there are like best-in-breed dog shows, there are best-in-breed rodent shows. Yes, it's apparently assessed by things like glossiness of coat, floppiness of ears, stiffness of bristle, you know, whatever. It's like, okay, so award-winning guinea pig there. Anyways, just in case you didn't know what a guinea pig looks like, okay, and this is an excellent example of guinea pigness. Charming little pets. I don't know why we don't use guinea pigs more, actually, in psychology now. I mean, I think they're much nicer to work with than rats. And don't get me wrong, it's not because rats creep me out. I like rats, you know, individually, sort of thing. But rats are nocturnal. And so you got to work on a completely, you know, your day-night cycle is off with the rats, and that creates some issues. You know, if you want to actually work with them, unless you've got, like, night goggles, you know, you've got to actually turn the lights on for the rats to run the study. And it's, like, they're nighttime, and that can actually be very stressful for animals because while it can get dark during the day, right, like cloud comes, like now, it's like, you know, started up nice this morning, all of a sudden it's like, you know, clouds everywhere, dark. But, you know, in the middle of the night, it doesn't typically just get really light, right? That's like unusual. That's weird. That's disturbing. So it actually causes cortical stress, really a hormone response is there. So, but guinea pigs are actually diurnal. Like they're awake at the same time you are. It's like, whoa, sweet. So you don't have to, you just, if the light's on, that works for the guinea pigs. Great. Anyways, what Munziger did is work with guinea pigs, and all the guinea pig had to do is press a lever to get some lettuce. So here we've got a guinea pig. That was interesting. This worked before when I did it. I don't know why we've got the little bits of guinea pig elsewhere. Anyways, so here's a guinea pig pressing a lever. Guinea pig could also use its nose. Guinea pig could, this graphic didn't work at all. Guinea pig could sit on the lever. Okay. So in Munziger's study, you just found guinea pigs did whatever. The object was press the lever. They just did it whichever way. Not one dominant operant behavior occurred. So this seems to be a little bit of a problem for stop action, but it does fit within what Lashley had called response classes. Lashley said that what's really significant here is just sort of the end goal. Right, so it's what exactly is it that's going to lead to the delivery of this outcome? And so anything at all, unless you've particularly shaped, unless the end goal is really specific, the only way you will actually get the reinforcer is if you press the lever with your bum. Okay, if you set that up, then it's like, yeah, the guinea pigs are going to press it with their bum, you know, but you know, right cheek or left cheek, you know, did you specify that? You know, maybe not. But if you just kind of leave it vague, press the lever however, then any old lever press will do. Now, I mean, you get into things like lever presses with rats. Rats are actually paw dominant. Okay, so, you know, I mean, humans, like 90% right-handed. Things like rats, typically about 50% right-hand or right paw, 50% left. So there may be a predisposition there for an individual. One individual may prefer to use the left paw, another one the right. Maybe they use both paws. It might just depend which side of the cage they're on when they're closest to the levers, to which paw they use. Okay. So from this point of view, Lashley is saying, there's a stop action that would end trying different stuff out, but if the stop action is press the lever, does it really matter if you use left paw, right paw, nose? It may not matter how you do it. There may just be something about cats. The cats may have these very particular ways of doing these sorts of behaviors. Or conversely, there may be something about Munziger's guinea pigs that just makes them much more variable in this. But still, the idea of response classes seems to work well. Unless you really specify something as to a precise way to receive the outcome, then anything that meets this sort of end goal can become the operant response. All right, so moving on a bit here, we get into B.S. Skinner, Berhus Frederick Skinner. And Skinner takes and shifts away from the discrete trial process and really is probably centrally important in terms of promoting the free operant technique. And he does this partially because he's just a gadget freak. If Skinner was alive today, he died in, I think, 1990. But, I mean, if he was alive today, I'm sure he'd, like, have the latest, you know, cell phone or iPad or BlackBerry or whatever, and be, you know, fiddling around with it and then get it to do something else by taking it apart and rebuilding it for some other purpose. He just tinkered with mechanical stuff. And so he builds then these operant chambers, sometimes called Skinner boxes, but he preferred operant chambers. So it's got a lever or a button or something to be pressed, a food or a water dispenser, and then he builds a cumulative recorder, which lets him just automate the recording process of this. So the responses, when reinforcers are delivered, when responses are made, this all just gets automated. Sinner said, look, you know, we also need to, he said, here's the thing. We're interested in, you know, operant learning. Let's think a little bit about the operant response. Really, we need something that's just going to be a meaningful, measurable unit of behavior. He said, it really doesn't matter terribly much what it is. Okay, but I mean, you know, you got, you know, studies with cats knocking over poles or flipping levers to open doors or whatever. Lots of ways they can do this. He said, does it matter how they do it? Is that what's important? Do you care how they're doing? Or do you just care that they come up with a way of achieving the outcome? If that's sort of what we're interested here, you know, unless we're specifically interested in, you know, why cat one does it in a different way from cat two, unless that's what you're really interested in, and he said, frankly, in a comparative psychology field, you're probably not. I mean, an ethologist might be interested in that, but comparative psychologists are more interested in just using these non-humans as models for human behavior. He said, in that case, all we really need is some sort of just measurable, meaningful unit of behavior. He says, that's what our operant responses should be. And we need to define it by the effect it has on the environment. Okay, just what is it to interpret? Does it deliver the outcome or not? Be it an appetitive or an aversive outcome. The little form of it, left paw, right paw, nose, butt, you know, pressing the lever, maybe doesn't matter so much. He says, what does it do to the environment? So this is a bit of a different approach here, but it becomes extremely popular. And interestingly, I mean, Watson's gone, you know, by now. He's by the time Skinner sort of shows up as a recently graduated grad student, Watson's been out of the picture for about a decade. And but Skinner very quickly sort of becomes the poster boy for behaviorism. And, you know, takes over sort of the mantle of John Watson's behavioristic approach. We should be studying observable behaviors and whatnot. And it's interesting, though, because I think there's a real underlying difference in sort of underlying philosophy between Watson and Skinner in terms of why one uses, takes this behavioristic approach. I think there's a bigger difference between the worldview. So just for interest's sake here, it's a little bit on this.
While some scientists engineer shiny new consumer goods for an eager public, Harvard psychologist B.F. Skinner seeks nothing less than the engineering of human nature. In experiments with subjects as simple as pigeons, Skinner declares that with the right social engineering, we can create a new breed of human beings. Skinner is firmly in the behaviorist tradition pioneered by John Watson in the 1920s. Like Watson, Skinner contends that with the right tools, we can predict and control behavior.
Skinner really inherited the mantle from Watson of behaviorism in this country, but it's kind of interesting to think about how there's a subtle difference in the way they went about it. Watson, as we know, ended up becoming an advertising executive, ended up embracing the American value system as it existed. Skinner was different. Skinner was a visionary. Skinner felt that through behaviorism, he could influence the world towards a greater humanity, not meet humanity where it was, but take humanity to a new place through the principles of behaviorism.
Picking up where Watson left off, Skinner wants to do the rigorous science to prove that environment is everything. Change the environment, he argues, and you can change the individual. Or in Skinner's case, the pigeon.
Skinner himself was a born gadgeteer. He had, in his own early years as a boy, for example, he developed ways of sorting ripe, I think it was cranberries, from unripe cranberries. He invented a cannon that would shoot things over his neighbor's fence. This was the kind of man he was. He was developing new ways to do everyday things in ways that were more comfortable, more efficient.
During World War II, Skinner had developed a pigeon guidance device for the U.S. military. While the Russians had dogs carrying bombs, and the Swedes had seals to blow up mines, Skinner had a plan of his own. Teaching pigeons to guide missiles to an enemy target. At the time, however, the military had no missiles to guide. But Skinner's pigeon research did not go to waste.
The way it was basically going to work, it's quite clever actually, was there'd be three pigeons in the missile and be three little windows. One pigeon has a window looking straight ahead, one sort of off to the left, and one off to the right. They're sort of going to be in these tubes. And the idea was you train the pigeon to, it's stimulus control, really. So you do previous training. If you see a picture of a munitions factory, you know, you... The pigeon pecks and it gets some grain. If it sees a pigeon, a picture of a hospital, and it pecks, it gets a shock. The aim here was not to blow up hospitals, but to blow up things like munitions factories or things like that. And so, if your missile's flying along, which the Americans didn't have any, but assuming it was, we'd be flying wrong. If there's a munitions factory straight ahead, the pigeon looking straight out the front window of the nose cone is going to be pecking the most. You know, the ones off on the left might be seeing a little bit of the corner of the munitions factory, the one on the right, just a little bit, you know, the other side sort of thing. So through discrimination, generalization, they'll peck less. But if the missile veers a little bit, now the pigeon on the right sees the munition factory most, it's going to be pecking a lot more. Now it's like, I see it, causing the missile to veer back. And in this hypothetical way, your missile is supposed to guide its way into the factory. I think he might have actually done better just like strapping, you know, a bomb onto 400 pigeons and giving them all to flap off together. But anyways, it was a novel approach.
He develops a system called operant conditioning to prove that a behavior will be repeated by a subject when rewarded. Repetition leads to reinforcement. Reinforcement, it changes the behavior.
So what he's doing here is just going to be using a shaping protocol. Okay, so.
Is moving about more or less at random. Sometimes it turns its head to the left. When it does, we reinforce that movement by giving the pigeon access to a dish of grain.
Skinner then waits for it to turn further. Again, more food. Ultimately, the pigeon will turn in a complete circle, having learned that only when he turns will he be rewarded.
What Skinner was able to do in very carefully controlled studies with animal models was to demonstrate that whole chains of behaviors could be built step by step, so that literally you could teach a pigeon to do complicated behaviors that no one would have predicted possible.
And Skinner believes that if it works for pigeons, why not people? In Skinner's mind, behavior is behavior, up and down the evolutionary scale, and it is all learned.
Come back to that in another video, I think, in a bit. Okay, so, right, so we've got that. So we saw very simple operant chambers there, just a more recent operant chamber, just quickly here. The sort of thing you buy now as opposed to building yourself should look, yeah. We'll look a bit more like this. And again, whether you're using a pigeon or a rat, they're remarkably similar devices there. Okay. Sometimes they're entirely enclosed, so you just shut the door on the subject, so they're in a little box, and it's less distracting for them. But anyways, okay, so that's a modern sort of operant chamber that one might buy from Fisher Scientific. Okay, so the other thing really that Skinner brings in particular, again, it's not anything that's inherently new. I mean, people have been training animals to do particular behaviors for Well, I mean, you know, probably as long as we've ever domesticated dogs, even training them to do very specific sorts of things. But the trial and error approach to studying behavioral output from Thorndike, he found rather, you know, intellectually interesting, but in terms of application, and Skinner was very much about application. What can you do with this? I mean, he develops a whole field of behavior modification for therapy based upon this. So he said, right, shaping, otherwise called successive approximations. We saw a little bit of it there where he's getting the pigeon just to turn in a counterclockwise circle. Because you can make very, very precise operant responses possible in this way. So just a few things. In terms of using shaping, we talk about either conditioned reinforcers or primary reinforcers. Your primary reinforcer is going to be any stimulus that will, you know, quote-unquote, naturally strengthen a response that it's paired with. A conditioned reinforcer, sometimes also called a secondary reinforcer, is a previously neutral stimulus that gets that has acquired the capacity to strengthen a response by being paired with a primary reinforcer. So in and of itself, a tweet on a whistle or a click on a clicker or whatnot is nothing. That's not a primary reinforcer, but it could certainly be a secondary, as long as you associate it with something as primary, like some food or water or electrical brain stimulation in the pleasure center, whatever that happens to be. In terms of shaping a lever press, then, it's going to be a gradual process. You just move towards a more appropriate or more precise response. Okay, so as you saw there, it generally often just works with the natural variability in behavior that subjects do. So, you know, Skinner just for whatever reason wanted the pigeon to turn to the left. Sometimes it turns right, sometimes it turns left. As long as you're quick with the button, if it turns a little bit to left, give it a little bit of food. You know, just wait. If it turns a little bit more, give it some food. Okay? You keep going until you get whatever response you need. If you're having problems, back up to an earlier phase and keep going there. So you can shape very specific sorts of things. Now, in this way, you can seem to produce a lot of behavioral or a lot of very stereotyped behavior. So, you know, you can shape 10 pigeons to turn to the left to get some grain. That being said, there's always going to be a little bit of variation in the responses. So the question is, you know, what's the sort of the degree of stereotypy that we get here? Part of this is going to be due to, you know, the impositions of the study, what's being imposed, like with Mueller's or Munsinger's guinea pigs, he didn't care. Just press the lever any old way. But, you know, your Skinner was saying, I'm only going to give you grain if you turn specifically complete circle to the left. Or, you know, the little car was going along there, you hit the little bell that causes the car to roll along a little bit more. That's very specific. Okay? So, you know, in some ways, if you make a more specific operant response required, you will have less variation in the outcome. In other cases, there may be, with respect to the individual, some cost-benefit differences here. So, you know, if the methodology hasn't specified must press lever with right paw to get the food, if the rat is on the is to the left, or probably to the right of the lever, well, he'd have to reach across his body with his right paw. Left paw is right there. Boom. So you might go, well, you know, maybe it's even a right paw dominant rat. Normally it would, you know, if it's sitting right in front, reach out with his right paw to this. But if it's off to the right anyway, well, left paw is closer. Why not just hit it with the left paw? Lower cost means, you know, you expend less energy doing that. You don't have to reorient. You don't have to stretch yourself out to do it. The actual, you know, energy gain from the food becomes higher at that point. So in this case, it may depend upon individual subject as well, where they are, what they're doing at the time, these sorts of things. You can actually condition variability into your subject. You can specifically shape for this. The way to do it is actually very easy. All you do is reinforce novel behaviors. if you set it up such that the only way you're going to get an appetitive outcome is if you do something new, then that's what you get. And you can even get this in things like pigeons. You can get some surprisingly novel behavior. Well, pigeons, you know, they don't really have much of a brain to speak of. How original can they be? How much can they remember? Aren't they just going to keep duplicating things? Surprisingly, they can do pretty good. Page and Nordinger in 85 had worked with pigeons. They had to do, they had two keys, left and right key. They had to make 8 pecks on the two keys. I mean, they could all be on one key, they could all be on the other key, some combination of them, go back and forth between them. The experimental group, they would only get reinforced, so the pigeons would only receive some grain if the response they make on this trial is different from any of the responses they have made on the previous 50 trials. So if on the first trial they respond on the left lever 8 times in a row, they can't use that again for the next 49 trials. It won't reinforce them. So on the second trial, they could do 8 responses on the right key. That'll get them screened. On the third trial, 4 on the left, 4 on the right, you know, fourth, 4 on the right, then 4 on the left. So the sequence had to be different. This is pretty impressive that the pigeons can actually kind of remember what they've done on the last 50 trials here and come up with something that's different. The control group, it didn't matter. For the control groups, it's just peck 8 times. Well, how do you want me to peck? I don't care how you peck. Just between those two keys, peck 8 times. Take a look what happens here. Over the first 5 sessions here, we find there's no real difference between our experimental control groups. Okay, there's a certain amount of novel behavior. For the experimental group, they get reinforced for novel behavior, for being original work, if you will. The control group, on the other hand, they find out that, you know what, you don't have to do that. Just whatever is easy to do, you know, if pecking the left key 8 times in a row every time is what gets you reinforced, great. Or if the pigeons, you know, whatever, pigeons got kind of a little rhythm going, left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, great, fine, whatever. But the pigeons would come up with things, pretty much individual things, that were the same. The variability dropped down because variability was harder to do. You got to remember, what have you done? What's going to be different? If all we do is reinforce you for producing 8 responses, same way, every time. Ever notice how sometimes artists, once they become kind of famous, they just kind of do the same thing over and over again, or more likely to, because it's worked for them in the past, right? I mean, can Jack Nicholson actually play anything other than Jack Nicholson? Right? I mean, good actor, great actor, right? But you go back and look at some of the stuff he did when he was much younger, and you get some real differences in his roles. After a while, it's just like you're hiring Jack Nicholson to play Jack Nicholson. Okay, he's just doing the same thing. Why? Because it sells movies. Okay. He doesn't really have to stretch himself that much for this. Occasionally, he does roles where he does do something different. But anyways, all right. What are some other mediators then in terms of responses? Well, belongingness is kind of a biggie here. Now, we encounter belongingness back with classical conditioning as well. These basically are biological predispositions. Okay, so different species will be predisposed to do some things more than others. Thorndike, for example, found that he just couldn't get the cats to sit in the puzzle box and scratch their ear or yawn for the door to open. It's like, all you got to do is yawn. You yawn, I'll open the door. Give you some tuna. Just come on, yawn. Cat's point of view is like, you're stuck in a box, right? I don't know, like you're a cat. You know, you crawl into a little cave or something falls down, right? You're trapped in the cave. Okay, yawning at the rock that's fallen over the cave entrance is not going to get it to move. Scratching your ear is not going to get it to move, right? You need to push at it or manipulate it or try to find a crack or run around, do something else. So some responses were just harder or basically impossible to condition as opposed to others. So that's the idea of belongingness here. So these are the biological predispositions. Breland, two of Skinner's graduate students who went off and decided to become animal trainers for zoos and theme parks and then eventually television advertising, discovered this with their study of instinctive drift, and this is the famous one with the raccoons and pigs to you know, put coins into banks there. And they find that by trying to shape the animals to approach these little piggy banks or little safes and drop a coin in it, they use food as the reinforcer. They shape them to gradually approach and drop the coin. But in a sort of stimulus substitution or auto-shaping kind of way, the coins come to take on the properties of the food. And so then these biological food-related behaviors come to the fore, and now the pig just tries to jump up and down on the coin or crush it, and because that's what you do with tough food. You know, you stomp on it, you root at it, you break it up so it's more easily digested. Raccoon starts rubbing coins together, you know, breaking up the shell on a crayfish or something like that by rubbing it, breaking it down again. And these biological predispositions, these species-specific food-related behaviors, take over, and they never really get the behavior. Starts going okay, but the further they get towards the end point, the end behavior there, the worse and worse and worse these biological predispositions come into effect. So this is called instinctive drift. Discovered completely accidentally by the Breelands. They didn't mean for that to happen. Here's something that was studied a little bit more intentionally, in this case by Skinner. So superstitious behavior paper from 48. what he's really dealing with, or what he describes, is accidental strengthening of a response. So he's got his pigeons. He's worked with 8 pigeons here. He's got them set on a variable time. I'm sorry. That's a typo. It's not variable time. It's fixed time. Remember to fix that. Sorry. This should be fixed FT. Fixed time. Yeah, TT. Good. Okay, fixed time. So every 15 seconds, grain just shows up. Sticks around for a few seconds and it vanishes. The pigeons don't have to do anything. Right? There's no response necessary. The pigeon could just, like, you know, lay down with its head in the food dispenser, open its beak, and the food will just drop into it. But something weird happens. After a while, the different pigeons, at least 6 of the 8 of them, start doing really specific, individually characteristic, completely unrequired responses. Now, again, there may be a little bit of biological predisposition in this. I mean, think about this. Food doesn't usually just, you know, I mean, if you're a young child, maybe people just come by and go, here's some food, right? Like, you know, periodically it's like, here's lunch, kids, you know, for my kids, or like, here's a cookie or something, you know, here's some iced tea, whatever it happens to be. But, I mean, generally speaking, if you want food, you have to go do something to get it, okay? So, here's the point of view. I mean, food just doesn't show up. You have to fly, or you have to search for it, you have to find it, you have to do something. You have to manipulate something. You have to peck open a bag that's been thrown in the garbage can to get some crumbs that have been left in there, whatever. And so what he finds is the pigeons start doing different things. Some, like, one sticks its head up in a corner, another does a little sort of shuffling back and forth, a little head bobbing in another one, whatnot. And Skinner says he thinks this is due to just accidental strengthening. So the pigeons just have variability of behavior. They just do different stuff. And if it just happens that for whatever reason they keep doing a particular behavior response just before that 15 seconds is up, it means that stop action, if you will, that last thing they did just before they got the grain, right? It's like I'm just bobbing my head, you know, little tune in my head, little pigeon song, just bobbing my head. Hey, there's some food. Go over, get the food. That was good food. Oh, yeah. Another song. Bobbing my head. Hey, there's some food. Go get it. After a while, what was the last thing you were doing before you got that grain? Well, yeah, I was bobbing my head. Let's try that again. Bobbing my head. There's the grain. Sweet. All I have to do is bob my head and they'll feed me. Mama said I was a stupid pigeon for becoming a lab pigeon, but I told her this would pay off eventually. Okay. Look, so he says, Ariel, says, you think about this in humans, you know, rituals, you know, personal societal superstitions. So these are very, very persistent. Okay. It's like, sure, you know, throwing salt over your shoulder probably doesn't really give you good luck, but it's a little bit of salt. You know, do you want to risk it? Try it. Got your lucky exam shirt. You wore it one time, you know, new shirt, just got a really good grade in the exam. It's like, why risk it? You know, there's a correlation there. Remember, correlations don't mean causation, but, you know, if you found a correlation, you know, so you gotta go with it. Yeah. Oh, sure, it could be the same way. I mean, that would probably make sense, right? Walking under ladders. I mean, if you're walking under a ladder, yeah, odds are there's something above you that could fall on you. You know, you jostle the ladder, especially in the, you know, the bricklayer that's 10 feet up falls off and crushes you. So, sure, you know, it's like, yeah, it's probably a problem. You know, oh, black cat crossing your path. You know, I mean, look, if a black cat runs in front of you, it's like, and then suddenly this dog came out of nowhere and bit me. Or that black cat... Why is the cat running? You know, it's like, why the chicken cross the road? You know, it's being chased by a fox. Why does the cat cross your path? It's being chased by a crazed mad dog. You know, I don't know. So maybe something bad happens there. Or, you know, boo, cat! You startledly fall in a mud puddle. Oh, the cat brought me bad luck. No, you're just clumsy. You know, but we look for these kinds of correlations. Anyways, Stadman and Simmelhag, over 20 years later, come back and reinterpret this. Now, they've got access to high-speed cameras at this point. So, you know, the same way that, you know, we get the stop-action principle being filmed with the cats and the poles, they're also now going back and sort of essentially doing the same thing as Skinner, but filming it so they can actually analyze frame by frame. When they do this, they interpret this very differently than Skinner did. Skinner said, look, you know, it's just you do something random, there's an appetitive outcome, it strengthens that. If you do that random, you know, do that behavior a few more times for whatever reason, and you get reinforced repeatedly, it's not because you've done that behavior, but if they go together, makes sense, predisposed to believe these things go together, you know, stuff you do causes things to happen, there you go. Stalin Simmelhag said, no, there's something else going on here. He said, by looking at this, we don't think there's just like a behavior. We think that the pigeon is sticking its head in the corner, you know, that Skinner talks about. You know, for whatever reason, Skinner just describes that as a behavior, but we think there's more going on from their film strip, their film footage of this. So it seems to be the pigeons are doing not just a behavior, but a bunch of perhaps different behaviors. They call these interim and terminal behaviors. Interim behaviors are behaviors that are done earlier in the time course before the food is delivered, and terminal behaviors are ones that occur pretty much just before the food is going to show up, or closer to the end of the period. I said, look, you know, subjects are going to have certain behavioral regularities. Sure, we see these, but I said they're temporally structured. I said there's going to be these things that are going to occur over a particular time course. And I said, based on knowing the time course, we can make predictions about what sorts of behaviors pigeons are more likely to be doing. So terminal behaviors, they said, are going to be species-specific behaviors, for example, that are specifically related to food anticipation actions. So it's like, oh, yeah, 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 the food is going to be here in just a couple of seconds, activates the species-specific food-related behaviors. The interim behaviors, though, it's like, oh, you know, it's still 10 seconds before food showing up. No point doing a food-related, no point just getting ready for it right now. I could go stand right in front of the food hopper, but there's not going to be food for a while, so I might as well do something else. Okay, so the interim behaviors, not motivated by food, you know. Turn around on the floor, pace a bit, do whatever. They said, that's not food-related. So just from some of their data here, probability of the occurrence of a behavior over the time course here. So... R3, let's see, this one down here is pecking at the floor. The response 4, this one, quarter turns, just quarter turning to the left or the right. This one here, R8, response 8, moving along the magazine wall, so just pacing along the wall. And they said these kinds of things are interim behaviors, interim responses. They don't seem to have anything to do with food specifically. These other ones, though, are R1, this one up here, and R7, this one down here. They said these are terminal behaviors, right? They're occurring towards the end of the time course. Now, so orient R1, orient towards the food magazine wall, R7, peck at the magazine wall, so peck close to where the food is going to be dispensed from. So, I get that. I understand what you're saying here, right? But, R7, this one here, it really doesn't start until a few seconds have passed, okay? And so it doesn't really start to become likely to occur, right, until you're partway through. So it's like, yeah, this is okay. R7, definitely a towards the end behavior here. I get that one. I'm kind of mixed about their interpretation with respect to R1, right? I mean, look at this. After 1 second, this is an incredibly prevalent behavior, orient towards the food magazine wall. Now, it's like, well, an interim behavior is something that happens early. Well, I mean, R1 is the first thing that happens here. Look, I mean, any of our other interim behaviors are like barely a probability at this point. They're hardly being done after like 1 second of time has elapsed. Poonk. You know, R1, high probability at that point. So I get the terminal bit over here, but I'm not sure that something like their R1 fits as well with the terminal behavior. I mean, it is definitely a food-related behavior, I agree with that, right? They're orienting towards the food magazine wall. It's like, oh yeah, that's where I have to check to make sure the food's coming, but it looks like they start doing it right away. So, you know, I don't know, their interpretation here is quite as good as they've argued. I'm not saying they're wrong. I'm just saying, you know, sometimes they may be trying to fit, maybe it's a little more complicated. And in fact, some people have suggested that it is more complicated than Staden and Simmelhagen's initial interpretation. So we can take a look at the behavior systems theory. We looked at that in the last chapter there as well, some behavior systems theory. Says, look, you know, periodic food delivery will activate then species-typical or species-specific feeding systems, activate these behavioral responses in terms of food. And these are going to be these species-specific, you know, pre-organized, they've got a belongingness that goes with them, they're predisposed. So if you look at it, so if you've just gotten food, okay, You might do what they might call a post-food focal search. So this is an attempt to kind of explain this sort of stuff, like R1, okay? So it says you basically, so the food's coming every, what's it, like 12 seconds or something, so or whatnot. So you've zero here, starting a new cycle. You just got food. It says, well, maybe you missed some, okay? So check out the wall by the magazine. Maybe there's a little bit more food over there. So this won't necessarily be R1, which Staden and Simmelhagen call terminal behavior. The behavior systems analysis said, no, this is what we call a post-food focal search. Check the area you were just in, see if you missed anything. Okay? As you get into the middle of the time, you know, so it's like, oh, okay, we got everything, didn't miss anything, right? It's like if you're sort of in that middle interval, it's like you're not expecting, you know, food to show up in a precise place. So, you know, do a general search. Wander around. Maybe there's some food someplace else, you know. Check it out. Peck the floor a little bit. Turn a quarter turn. Look over there. Look over to the other side. Look about. Do I see any food anywhere else? Then as you get closer to when the food is supposed to be delivered again, you go back into these food focal searches. It's like, I know food's going to come over for this magazine. Got to get over to the magazine. I'm going to peck on the wall by the magazine. So the behavior systems theory says, yeah, Staden and Simmelhagen's not entirely correct here. Okay. How about reinforcer values? Does that have any effect on behaviors here? Well, in fact, it does quite a lot. So the response magnitude, the rate of learning, these are all influenced by reinforcers themselves, by the outcomes. The quantity and the quality certainly do this. So, you got to be a little careful about this. I mean, you know, your individual subjects have to be, again, whether it's species or individual there, have to be able to actually assess the differences in magnitude. So if you've got quantity, right? You know, over here we're going to give you 11 pieces of little food. Over here we're going to give you 10 pieces of food. A lot of studies with non-human animals say that for a lot of the non-humans, they can sort of do things like, you know, one, two, lots. Or, you know, a few, one, two, three, more, a whole bunch more. So in terms of, you know, 10 versus 11, they may be a little bit vague on that. So it's like, oh, look, I made it different. Yeah, they can't tell. Okay? So that's something just to keep in mind. Generally speaking, there's a positive correlation for what I might call single operant tasks, like run a maze or do something like that. Generally, the higher the quality of the reinforcer at the end, and the higher the greater the quantity, the more rapidly they'll perform, the more rapidly they will learn. This does get more complicated when we get into higher schedules or more complex kinds of tasks, and we'll actually come back to this in the next chapter when we get into choice behavior. You can then change the reinforcement magnitude as well, and this involves then a reinforcement history. So what's your expectation? If you've been expecting that you're not, you know, you're going to get X units of reinforcement here, and you get 5X, well, that was unexpected. Holy smokes. Next time, you know, you respond really quickly. Tolman and Hanzig's Tolman and Hanzig's study of latent learning. So first group of rats through the maze, nothing at the end. Second group of rats through the maze, food waiting for them. They learn the maze very quickly. Our first group of rats, they just wander all over the place. They never seem to know where they're going. Okay, so nothing going on there. They make wrong turns, whatnot. Third group of rats for the first 10 days, no food. They're just like our first group. They're just wandering all over the place. They have a hard time getting to the end. But on the 11th day there, there's food waiting for them. Like, woohoo, look at this. There's food. Day 12, bam. They're as good as the rats who have been getting food from the very start. Not like these, our third group actually just learned the maze in one day. They learned it the whole time, but their expectation was, yeah, I get to the end and there's nothing waiting for me. Why hurry? Right? No point. Okay? So we can talk about positive and negative behavioral contrast there. Right? So, you know, are you going to get a greater outcome on the next trial? Positive is going to be less? What's our expectation? And that'll change things as well. We can also talk about our response and reinforcement contingencies. So we've got causal relationships here, if you will. The stronger, your textbook calls it tough causal, the stronger the contingency you've got. So the stronger a contingency between your response and your reinforcer, typically the stronger your responding is going to be and the faster your learning is going to be. In fact, if you have non-contingent or random relationships, you'll often lead to actually a lack of responding. So, I mean, if you're trying to train up a non-contingent relationship from the beginning, your subject's just probably not going to respond to begin with. If you take something that you've shaped, you've got a response going on, and then you switch it to non-contingent, so now there's no contingency between a response and the outcome, you'll get into extinction. In fact, the subject's responding is going to just drop off. It's going to stop. Because what I do does not determine what happens. No point doing what I'm doing. Temporal contiguities. And, you know, I'm pretty much so close to getting done. I'm out of time. Okay. We'll pick this up next class. And as I said, I think we'll probably have my friend here with her helper dog to talk to you a little bit about some shaping and stuff like that. So come on by for that one, and otherwise have a good weekend.